Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Tulsa Historical Society recently opened a new exhibit, part of their ongoing effort to tell the story of our community decade by decade. Tulsa in the Teens, from boomtown to oil capital, depicts the quick rise of the community and the early Tulsa boosters' determination to ensure that the city did not suffer the fate of most boomtowns, that is, busting once the minerals were depleted. And Tulsa had a lot to overcome. Bad water, a prairie river between it and the oil fields, yet Tulsa leaders persevered. At home, oil families from the east were busy creating cultural institutions that lasted this day, and a world war would depend on Oklahoma oil to fuel it. Tulsa in the Teens, from boomtown to oil capital, is on display at the Tulsa Historical Society through February of next year. My guest today is the Director of Exhibits and Education at the Tulsa Historical Society, Maggie Brown. Maggie Brown, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
The Tulsa Historical Society has just opened its latest big exhibit, and you do this about once a year, once every 18 months. You sort of have been chronicling a decade in Tulsa's history, and this is the 19-teens. What is important about Tulsa in the 19-teens?
Well, there's a huge amount of change in the city in the 19-teens, and it's really when Tulsa is becoming the oil capital of the world. Just a few years before this decade begins is the discovery of the Glenpool oil field. And so there's a huge change in the industry, in the community, and a flood of people coming from different areas of the country into northeastern Oklahoma for the oil. And then at the beginning of the teens, the Cushing oil field, which is much larger than the Glenpool discovery, is found, and things just boom. And there are just lots and lots of people and businesses and oil men from across the country that relocate to Tulsa and start to develop the city.
Now, this is the question that's always interesting to me because, you know, boom towns come and go, and boom towns oftentimes are there as long as the money is to be made, and then it's off to the next place, wherever it was. What happened to Tulsa to actually make it into a city?
And that's a great question, because that is one of the most important things that happens in the teens, is that the community leaders at the time, they were afraid of that very thing happening. And so they established lots of businesses, banks, hotels, all sorts of industries to help support the growing oil industry to help keep people in Tulsa.
And when you think of the Cushing field, that's about equidistance between Oklahoma City and Tulsa. It seems, with Oklahoma City being the state capital, that would be a natural place for those oilmen to gravitate to. Why would they come back to Tulsa?
And so it really is, again, because of the community leaders and their development. They were very determined to get people to Tulsa. Cushing isn't right next door to Tulsa, so there's no reason that the workers or the oil company owners would have ever even come to Tulsa. But basically, the community leaders developed all of these different businesses to make them want to come and do their business and live in Tulsa.
And I guess the 19-teens is when they start looking at what they have. I guess the railroad had already come to Tulsa by this point.
That's right. And actually, by the time the Cushing field is discovered, there are three different railroads that are going through Tulsa. And the first railroad had run through several decades earlier. But that certainly helped Tulsa's development. And so they progressively developed more and more infrastructure to be prepared, basically, for this new oil boom that was coming.
Of course, roads were starting to become important. And so also in the 19-teens, you see efforts to improve access across the river. This is the time when the first concrete multi-level span bridge was built over the Arkansas, and that's the 11th Street Bridge. That was the old 11th Street Bridge.
And
that was very important.
The bridge was very important because most of the oil industry is on the west side of the river, and there's not a good way for people or equipment to get across the river before bridges are built. And at one point, a little farther back in time, there had only been a railroad bridge. And so people used to, there are stories about people taking apart their wagons and carrying them across the railroad bridge and putting them back together. Of course, the railroad was not a fan of that idea. And so eventually there becomes, you know, a toll bridge and then eventually a public bridge that's free. And that's very important to getting people into the city of Tulsa.
So beyond just showing that Tulsa's leadership wanted to make sure it wasn't a boom town, which, you know, you look at some of the great boom towns of the West around mineral deposits. I mean, there would be opera houses, there would be all sorts of development, but when the silver or the minerals played out, those towns basically became ghost towns. So they were really determined to avoid that distinction. What were some of the other forces that shaped Tulsa in the 19-teens?
Well, besides all of the community development, there were also lots of cultural organizations that formed, which I think would have been something that the women specifically appreciated. They might have come from a larger East Coast city and got to Tulsa, and there might not have been any of those entertainment venues that they were used to back home. And so what did those women do? They immediately started establishing their own organizations. And some of those organizations are still around today that started back in the teens.
For example?
For instance, the Tuesday Book Club, which is a club that still exists. And the Tuesday Book Club actually formed the first library in Tulsa during the 19-teens. Hmm. And then that was eventually taken over by the city. But, you know, that was a really impressive thing that they accomplished. And Haichka, which is something that actually formed a few years before that, and is the Creek word for music. And so they were a music group, and they donated the first organ to Convention Hall, which is now known as the Brady Theater, and that was built in the teens. And they brought in performers from all over the world to perform in Tulsa. So there are many groups that formed that really brought these international experiences to Tulsans.
Now, I think, I'm not sure if it's a myth or there's a truism at its heart. One of the things that was special about Tulsa was you had an awful lot of Eastern oilmen who came with their families, and those families, being settled in Tulsa, wanted East Coast creature comforts as well as artistic outlets, cultural outlets. And that's one of the things that really sealed Tulsa's fate to grow beyond its mineral wealth.
Absolutely. And there were so many people that came from the East Coast specifically because the oil industry had previously been in Pennsylvania. That's where it was centered. And before long, it was centered right here in Tulsa. And there was an office for almost every oil company that existed here. And all of these oil men, either aspiring or already established oil men, moved to town, brought their families, built these amazing houses during especially the 20s. We think of neighborhoods like Maple Ridge mm-hmm. as something that, of course, everyone, you know, still loved to live in those houses. But those were the kind of things, you know, they definitely came here and made their families comfortable and, again, developed these cultural organizations so that there was involvement and culture for the community.
Now, when people come to see the exhibit, what sort of things are you going to show them that, you know, what sort of objects does the Tulsa Historical Society have access to give a sense of what Tulsa was like in the 19-teens?
Well, this is our biggest gallery, so it really allows us to immerse people in the teens. We hope that people, when they walk into the gallery, they get a sense that they're really stepping back in time and they're stepping onto Main Street in the teens. So we have lots of large still photographs that really help accomplish that goal. Two of our centerpieces in the exhibit are two Model Ts that belong to Ted and Nancy Forkham, who are two Tulsans. We have a Model T from 1910 and one from 1915. And people are always amazed when they see those. And one is sort of the stereotypical black Model T that people think of mm-hmm. when they think Model T. And the 1910 is actually white, and it has lots of brass fixtures. And it was something that was made before Model Ts were so mass-produced, and there weren't nearly as many made. And it was actually more expensive in 1910 than it was
like
in 1915.
More like a luxury car.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so those are really interesting to people and getting to quiz people about, you know, what do you think that part of the car is? And
now, I know that the Historical Society owns a Tulsa 4, which was... Now, was that earlier?
Actually, no. The Tulsa 4 was manufactured from 1917 to 1922.
So it's a little later, maybe.
And that car is actually at the airport. So that allows people to enjoy a little piece of the teens as they pass through the airport as well.
So you have two Model Ts. You said you try to immerse them into Main Street. What did Main Street look like in the 19-teens? Did we have paving by that point? I know when you think of the old historic photographs of Main Street, it's still a muddy street.
That's right. The streets were being paved during the teens. So again, the city developers are really trying to make this into a big city. And the buildings get taller and taller downtown. And actually, it's hard for the building to keep up with the increase in population. So that many of the oil men, they have their offices in hotels while they're waiting to build their own buildings, or they're living in hotels while they're building their houses. And the community is just trying to build as quickly as possible during that decade.
Now, I've always heard that during the oil boom, a lot of the action happened in hotels. Was that because they were simply living in hotels? And so that was a great place to make a deal?
I think that did have a lot to do with it. But also, hotels were a great place if you were bringing people in from out of town to meet with them. And the Hotel Tulsa, which was the hotel that people think of really being associated with the oil industry, and people have referred to it as the real oil headquarters, and that there were, you know, million-dollar deals made there in the lobby. I think there's a story about Josh Kosten writing a $10 million check sitting there in the lobby. And so it was a great place to impress people coming from out of town and just to meet even with people who might also live here.
Mm-hmm. I always heard that associated with the Mayo Hotel, but the Hotel Tulsa, that's no longer here, is it?
That's right. The Hotel Tulsa was torn down several decades ago. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the Mayo Hotel comes along a little later. So that's why the Hotel Tulsa is around in the teens. And all that
action moved to the Mayo once it was built.
Yes. Yeah.
My guest today is Maggie Brown, the Director of Exhibits and Education at the Tulsa Historical Society. The Tulsa Historical Society is offering a new major exhibit, Tulsa and the Teens, From Boomtown to Oil Capital. These are usually on display for about 12 to 18 months, and they just finished one on the 1890s, right?
That's right.
And you're sort of taking Tulsa decade by decade, but you're skipping around a little bit.
We are. We don't like to keep things just completely traditional, so we do skip around. And that gallery is large enough that we can really tell the story of an entire decade.
Big enough for two cars and plenty of room left over.
That's right.
So give us an example of some of the objects that sort of help tell the story.
Okay. Well, we have lots and lots of artifacts and photographs in the exhibit. We have lots of things that are related to different businesses in Tulsa. For instance, we have a great sign from the Brady Hotel that existed back in the teens. We have things that people would have had in their home. So we have a Victrola as well as a cylinder recorder. And cylinder recorders, that's one of those things that some people know about, but not everyone. But that was actually the first format to play records.
That's the old Edison machine.
That's right. It was developed by Thomas Edison and basically was beat out in a format war, as we've had throughout the ages, by the Victrola. So that's what we all, you know, had then for decades after that, where we played real records, the records we think of as being real records instead of cylinder recordings. And we have lots of military uniforms and equipment, of course, because World War I was happening during the decade, and that was one of the major events that affected the world, but also, of course, every community, including Tulsa.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of the artifacts that you were particularly proud that you were able to lay your hands on for this exhibit?
Well, one of my favorite collections that we have that we're showcasing in this exhibit is from the dedication of the SS Tulsa, which was a ship that Tulsa earned the right to name by selling war bonds.
Right.
And it's kind of amazing the amount of money that was raised within the community. And Tulsa was actually raised the second most money in its population category. It was actually beat out by Lincoln, Nebraska. And so what that meant originally was that Lincoln would be able to name a ship and Tulsa would be able to name a tank. But they actually stopped manufacturing tanks, and so then Tulsa also got to name a ship. And so when that ship was launched, it was christened in an untraditional way, which was using a bottle of crude oil.
Ah, interesting.
And so we actually have the netting that held the bottle that was used to christen the ship, and a nice box that goes in, and we have a whole photo album and lots of newspaper clippings from the time.
I would assume lots of photographs from that era. Is there much from the Beryl Ford collection that's a part of this exhibit?
There is. And, of course, the Beryl Ford collection is an amazing treasure that we actually hold as part of our archives. And that collection in and of itself contains, I think, about 30,000 images, in addition to the tens of thousands of images we have in our own permanent collection.
And everything from, like, the doors of Central High School to everything else. I mean,
yes,
he collected anything that was being demolished or
leveled. Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. And so that's just an amazing treasure, and we always feature lots of photographs, and if there are artifacts from the right time period, in all of our exhibits that we do.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know you try to tell the home story as well. What was, you know, the domestic story of the 19-teens for the typical Tulsa household?
The typical household is a lot like it is today. There is no typical household. We try to include the variety of different households there were. So we have pictures of oil mansions, and we also have some really great pictures of the houses that people lived in if they worked in the oil fields. And, you know, these little tents, basically, little shacks that they lived in. And so that it's interesting to see the difference there between how one part of the community was living in the other. And then, of course, we have furnishings that people would have had in their homes, toys that children would have had, mm-hmm. all sorts of things.
Now, the desirable neighborhood in that time, would that still have been Reservoir Hill and Brady Heights at that point?
The community was still sort of moving to the north and just barely to the south.
Yeah, so Maple Ridge hadn't been created
That's
yet.
Right. Maple Ridge was built in the 20s. And mm-hmm. one of the things that was happening to sort of get people from place to place in Tulsa during the teens was the building of the trolley lines. And one of the trolley lines is described as running all the way out to 18th and Utica, which is where Orcutt Park, which was the first amusement park, was located. And of course, that is just barely out of downtown today. Mm-hmm. But that, you know, the community hadn't really grown that far mm-hmm. during the teens.
What are some of the other events in the 19-teens that Tulsa really helped them grow? Well, we talked a little bit about the 11th Street Bridge. That was a big addition. Also, at least in the teens, and I guess the exhibit won't really focus too much on this because it really was finished in the 20s, was the Spavinaw project, getting access to clean water.
That's right. Water was a huge concern for Tulsa as all of the oil companies began to come here, and they were very dissatisfied with the quality of water. There are stories that people tell of the Arkansas River, which is where water had come from originally, and that it was so salty and sandy that once you took a bath and dried off, you'd then have to brush the salt and sand off of yourself. And so it was a huge concern. People actually drank a lot of bottled water. During the teens, people were drinking 50,000 bottles of water a week in Tulsa.
And most of that was coming from Shell Creek in Sand Springs.
That's right. Yeah. So that, of course, was a huge business. And the community knew something had to be done because oil companies were threatening to actually leave if Tulsa didn't fix their water situation. And so they did, in fact, pass a bond issue in 1919 for the Spavinaw Water Project, which I believe was the biggest bond issue ever passed in the country at that point in time.
In fact, prior to that, when you drive around New Block Park, you see the waterworks. That was actually a treatment plant for Arkansas River water, which it was built in the teens as well.
And the Spavinaw story is so interesting because people don't really think about where their water comes from or the challenges in getting their water over time. And it was a really big problem in Tulsa, and it was solved. So that's another thing that the community did in their development.
The Tulsa Historical Society is presenting Tulsa and the Teens from Boomtown to Oil Capital. It will be on display all the way through 2013 and probably into 2014. I think February is the closing date. My guest today is Maggie Brown, the Director of Exhibits and Education. Give us an example of what you try to, the philosophy of the things you exhibit at the Tulsa Historical Society. You're trying to tell the story of Tulsa, but you're trying to tell it in different ways, from industry, from cultural trends to time periods. Give us an example of what the philosophy is.
Well, we have 8 different exhibit galleries at the Historical Society, and they each rotate about once a year. And we try to cover different themes, different time periods, so that there's basically something for anyone who walks in the door, that every person that visits can find something that they're particularly interested in. Some stories that we tell are smaller and some are larger, decades being a larger story. And we just try to change and do different things. We also try to really listen to our visitors and our membership and get ideas about what they'd like to see in the future. And we definitely take that into account.
I know you really depend on partners. For example, some of our employees here had, they were involved in Top 40 radio. So they worked with the Historical Society to create the KAKC exhibit. I know Wayne McCombs was a great, valuable resource on baseball history, and you had a great exhibit on sort of the history of baseball in the city. That's the sort of thing you're doing. You often look for partners to help sort of tell a story.
Absolutely. Anytime there's another organization or individual that has a collection or knows about a subject, we always try to get them to come and help with our exhibit. And the KAKC exhibit is such a perfect example and a very popular exhibit that everyone was very sad to say goodbye to just a little while ago.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know you're currently working on a Theater Tulsa exhibit. This is their 90th anniversary season, and this is, again, one of those cultural institutions that was created about the time that you're talking about.
That's right. Theater Tulsa began in 1922, and they actually began out of the AAUW, the American Association of University Women, which is something I learned about them as I started doing research. And so they've had 90 seasons, which is pretty amazing. One of the strongest community theaters in the country over time. And I think they are the oldest continuously operating community theater west of the Mississippi is how they promote themselves, which is great. They have an amazing archives as well. I've been spending lots of time going through it and looking at all of their old playbills from their productions and photos. It'll be a really interesting exhibit for people to come see, whether they're interested in Theater Tulsa or just the theater in general, or even if they're not interested in that, I think everyone will find something they're interested in that exhibit.
Now, a number of noted actors have come through that company over the years. Will you have stills of some of their Theater Tulsa performances?
We will definitely include any famous people, you know, names that people will recognize if they are available in photos. Yeah. Some of the people that have gone through over time, maybe they weren't a lead character, and so maybe there's not a photo of them, but we definitely will try, because that's something that's very interesting.
Are there famous Tulsans for other reasons that are show up in Theater Tulsa productions?
There are definitely some well-known names over the years, and so that'll be really interesting for people to see as well.
Yeah. You know, I know that you're a historian, and this is, you know, the job you have, but what are the things that you have found as a historian that's been fascinating you about Tulsa in your time with the historian?
One of the things that I actually first learned about Tulsa when I first moved here is the amazing philanthropy that goes on in Tulsa, going back to the very early years of the community. And I've always been very impressed by the people in the community who have done well for themselves and given so much back. It's pretty amazing. You don't find that in every community. So that I find really interesting.
Really? What sort of, I know Tulsa philanthropy has always been a part of the community, but what sets it apart in your mind?
For instance, people like Waite Phillips, who built buildings or built homes and then deeded them to specific organizations or communities to help support them. And the rents of,
like, the Phil Tower and the Philcade going to the Boy Scouts.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Or that, you know, Waite Phillips' home becoming Philbrook. Or Thomas Gilcrease. I realize his collection was purchased for the community, but still he created this amazing collection.
Really, with the idea of giving it to the citizens of Tulsans at some point, I would think. I think that would have to be a part of his collection philosophy.
So I think that's an amazing thing about Tulsa, that people have been so generous from the very early years of the community.
Mm-hmm. Well, the name of the exhibit is Tulsa and the Teens, From Boomtown to Oil Capital. How long did it take to put this display together?
Our main exhibits actually take about 1,000 hours of work. And so that usually takes 3 or 4 months, really, to do all of that work. A lot of it is behind the scenes work that is scanning photos and doing research and picking out artifacts from the collection, or finding people in the community to lend items for the exhibit. And then actually putting it all in the gallery takes a little less time. Mm-hmm. Although it's the part that people like to watch as the exhibit materializes.
Now, will you be continuing with this decade look down the road? Or are you starting to prepare for 2014, for the next decade?
Yes, and the next decade we will be doing is the 1930s.
All right, well, we hope a lot of people come out to see Tulsa in the Teens at the Tulsa Historical Society. It's a great resource. If you're around the Garden Center, pop into the Historical Society. You can walk through the Tulsa's history. Maggie Brown, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Maggie Brown is the Director of Exhibits and Education at the Tulsa Historical Society. Tulsa in the Teens, From Boomtown to Oil Capital, is on display at the Tulsa Historical Society throughout the year. It will close in February of 2014. Gallery hours are Tuesday through Saturday, 10 to 4, and you can learn more at tulsahistory.org. Thank you. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. Here's the comments of Dr. John Schumann.
I train doctors. In my role as a residency program director, I have three major responsibilities: recruiting, regulation, and reasoning. Regarding that last one, my goal is to have trainees demonstrate competence as doctors at the end of their three-year residency. Ideally, doctors in training acquire competence in steady, graded fashion at distinct mileposts along the way, so that teaching faculty know that they are making adequate progress and will flourish as independent doctors. How do professions measure and determine competence? In medical training, residency programs are subject to regulations provided by residency review committees, which are empowered by a national accrediting body. Those committees come for periodic site visits to inspect our training environment and make sure that we're following best practices. Oh, and the rules. It's up to us to comply with their rules, but we have leeway in interpreting them so that there can be innovation in how we implement our educational models. In the last decades, said governing bodies were able to choose six core competencies that define competence for doctors of all specialties. Regardless of what kind of medicine you practice, there should be fundamental attributes that all doctors share, right? Those six competencies are patient care, duh, medical knowledge, also duh, interpersonal skills and communication, hey, I kind of like that, professionalism, for sure, right, systems-based practice, huh, practice-based learning and improvement. I think you lost me on these last two. Give yourself an exercise. Now that you know the domains of competency, how would you evaluate learners in those domains? Unsurprisingly, medical educators began resorting to numeric grading scales to evaluate residents in each of the domains. This allowed for quantification of residents' performances and a better ability to document both interval progress and ultimate competence. The problem became that different faculty members interpreted the grading scales differently. Grade inflation started making nearly everyone look the same as far as their evaluation numbers were concerned. Asked to define what makes a competent doc, faculty responded along the lines of Supreme Court Justice Potter Stewart, who famously quipped about the hard-to-define concept of obscenity. I know it when I see it. Voila! Welcome to the next accreditation system. Program directors like me across the country are currently struggling to implement this new system, with the goal of allowing more detailed analyses of learners' performances. Another goal of the new system is to allow more freedom and flexibility in educational innovation by making reporting requirements more frequent but less onerous. Hey, will that work? This is going to keep educators' eyes more fixed on teaching and training than on evaluating and reporting. I'm imagining that in the near term, there will be a lot of the latter. I hope the former is not diminished. The new system is predicated on developmental milestones that lead doctors to become competent in a range of entrustable professional activities. These EPAs map to the original six competencies which I shared with you above. Got it? At a recent national meeting discussing these changes and strategies for handling them, one colleague likened these new mandates to repairing the airplane while flying it. No one ever said that change is easy. Best for us to embrace it and make it a learning opportunity.
Dr. John Henning Schumann is a regular contributor to Studio Tulsa. He hosts our Studio Tulsa on Health segment and directs the Internal Medicine Residency Program at the University of Oklahoma School of Community Medicine. He also writes the blog Glass Hospital. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you miss one of our recent programs, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. Just search for Studio Tulsa and you can listen at your leisure. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.